From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, our weekly discussion with Joe Loria, the editor-in-chief of ConsortiumNews.com, about the headlines at ConsortiumNews.com. And we're going to start today with a story that says, essentially, the dead in Yemen, much larger count than everybody thinks, and everybody's saying how horrible it is. Let's talk about that first, Joe.
Well, thanks, Don. I'm really happy to be here in studio with you for the first time, up from Washington. Yes, the Yemen story now has become finally a hot story for the corporate media. As you, everyone knows, they've been more or less ignoring that, except from the very beginning of the war. And why? Because the U.S. has played, and the U.K. have played a major role in logistical support, refueling of planes, choosing bombing targets. They've had a big hand in that. I've always felt that this war began in the Obama administration, by the way, and now suddenly we're getting Democrats saying this war has to end. Mm. And we had Samantha Power, for example, tweeting that this is Trump's war somehow. It was under her own administration,
right,
blaming Trump for this. Right. Now, I do blame Trump for continuing it.
Right.
But the idea of letting Obama off the hook is just absurd, but typical in the hyper-partisan environment we're
with Trump, by the way. You know, when he backs off in Syria, for example, they yell at him. He's being Putin's puppet and everything. And so if he were to lean out of Yemen, you know, pull the U.S. out of there right now, he'd be hearing grief from those same people.
Possibly, but things have changed because of the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, of course.
Yeah,
that changed everything. One of their own, as they assume, because he wrote a column for the Washington Post, one of their own was killed. Now, he really wasn't a journalist, as Assad Abdul Khalil wrote in one of our stories a couple of weeks ago, a very fine profile of Khashoggi, and told us a lot of things, that he worked with Osama bin Laden closely in Afghanistan, for example. The guy is a defector, and that's why he was probably killed.
Yeah.
And there is no journalism in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. But anyway, he's seen as one of them, so therefore this scandal is, you know, of course it's horrible that he was killed, but the idea that this now is bleeding over into the Yemen war. So there's been a bill in Congress for a while to get the U.S. to stop helping, but it's starting to go somewhere now, and the voices are raising. So now it's time to look at how many people have actually been killed with American help in Yemen since the war began 5 years ago, or 4 years ago. And that figure has always been hovering around, you know, within 5,000 to 10,000 for all this time by the World Health Organization.
Right.
But our article now points to an NGO that admitted their mistake and went back and upped their estimates of the number of people killing Yemen to between 70,000 and 80,000 when they had just a couple of months earlier said that it was around 10,000, which was the World Health Organization figure.
Hey, UNICEF, meanwhile, in December 2016, said that a child was dying every 10 minutes in Yemen. Everything's worse now than it was then. That's 2 years this coming month. So that's 24 months. You know, one every 10 minutes is 144 a day, or 14, 28, 4,200, 4,300 a month, or almost 50,000 a year.
That's
times
right.
2 years.
That's right.
So that's just 100,000.
That's
using
right.
UNICEF
I actually
numbers.
Did the arithmetic as I was editing the story, and it was 104,000.
Okay.
So I just said in the piece more than 100,000 because that's an estimate.
So I did pretty good in my head.
Not bad. Here on this, right here, while we're recording this interview, that's pretty good. I did it. I took my time in advance to do that. So that's a shocking figure, obviously.
Yeah.
That includes deaths, however, from diseases. Diphtheria and cholera have been a big cholera epidemic that's broken up because of the war. So it is a war death. It's not necessarily from a bomb, but it's from a disease that would not have existed except for this war. So 100,000 people more have been killed from all causes due to this war. And it's shocking and horrible. And this number has to get out there to increase the anger there should be in the public and in Congress in particular to end this bloody conflict, because it's an outrage what's gone on. It's really been an unbelievably criminal war that's been ignored in the West.
Yeah.
And supported in the Gulf media, Gulf Arab media, of course. They're part of the coalition.
Yeah. Yeah, it factors into domestic politics in Saudi Arabia, too. If you can call that, I don't know what, that mania that goes on there, domestic politics. You know, Salman and just locally, the new guy's project, this is one of two. The other one, well, you had the Bahrain occupation. And then you have this war against Yemen. Oh, and of course, and Syria.
Well, Syrian war and the Bahrain invasion, well, they asked them in, so they their right. intervention into Bahrain happened before Mohammed bin Salman, the son of the king,
right.
Had any kind of portfolios in government.
Right.
But he was the defense minister, and he had a couple other portfolios, but he was a defense minister when this Yemen war was launched. So this is his war,
right.
And it's gone badly. And, you know, in a normal country, even with our very defective democracy we have in the United States, there are times when the public can, and people in Congress can get fed up and there could be a change. That is not going to happen in Saudi Arabia. As long as he wants, nobody could step, could open their mouths and say a word in Saudi Arabia that this war is horrible, we're killing these people for nothing, we're wasting money because the economy, even in Saudi Arabia, as rich as they are, there's a huge population there of 80 million or so, and they're not all rich in Saudi Arabia like there could be in
right.
Qatar, where there's only 250,000 citizens. So the money they've got there, they can pay everybody off. So that thing, you know, this becomes an issue in Saudi Arabia, the cost of the war and the fact they're not winning. He's losing this war. He
right.
could not defeat Yemen, the poorest country in the region,
right.
and being attacked by the richest country in the region, and they can't win. So in any system where there was some kind of level of accountability for leaders, this war would have really nailed Salman, Mohammed bin Salman, and who's now, of course, become the crown prince in line to become the king. And but it hasn't at home, and it didn't in the West until the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the guy who was writing op-eds for the Washington Post. That has upset the corporate elite media because one of their own was killed. Now it's a big deal. And of course, his murder was horrible, but it's not horrible compared to the 100,000 people we've just been talking about that were killed in Yemen. It's nothing compared to that. But now in the U.S., we're seeing in Congress and in the media, the New York Times did this huge piece in the magazine section 2 weeks ago about this war in Yemen. So now they've discovered it all of a sudden because of the murder of Khashoggi. So at least something, you know, there's a reason for the attention now. But still, we have to look, as we do in this piece, at the numbers of killed. That has not seeped out because they're still quoting these U.N. figures, which are abominably low.
And outdated.
And outdated, yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's 2 years out of date.
So we were happy to have this piece from Nicholas Davies. We wrote it.
Yeah, to give us a little background on Nicholas.
Well, Nicholas has written a book about the war deaths in Iraq, and he mentions that in his piece. And then he did a three-part series for Contorting Music earlier this year, and he looked at war deaths from U.S. wars since the last few years. So this is a air specialty for him, and he looks beyond the numbers and looks at the methodology behind counting war deaths. And unfortunately, there was a quote, I think it was Tommy Franks, the general during the Afghan conflict, or
yeah.
where he was quoted as, or in Libya, I can't remember which war, there's so many of them,
yeah.
but he said, we don't count the dead of the civilians right. on the inside.
Right.
You don't count them. Now, maybe right. they do and it's secret. I don't know, but they don't make a deal. They don't want any attention paid to this. That's horrific, if you ask me. Yeah. That is just so sociopathic, Don, really.
Wow.
That we go there and kill all these people and we don't count them and don't want anybody to count them. And remember, the New York Times, it gives, to their credit, did a real study about how many people were killed in Libya.
Right.
And they came up with a very large figure.
Yeah.
And they ran that on the front page. And I was surprised that the Times did that because that's what journalism is all about, to hold the government to account. They don't count the numbers. Well, we have to then as reporters. So,
you know, the population of Libya, if I recall, when I was there in October of 2009, was around 8 million, and at the end of the U.S. war on Libya in October, I guess formally October 20th of 2011, population was 6 million. Now, there was a mass exodus of
right,
people,
right.
you know, across the Mediterranean and across Africa, so we don't know how many people died and how many people ran for their lives, but that's an awful lot of dislocation. That's a quarter of the population.
Sure, it's on the scale of almost of Syria, which was worse, though.
Yeah. I mean, that would be like 75 to 80 million people in the United States.
Yeah just disappearing somehow.
Yeah. Well, also, I remember reporting back pretty close to the beginning of the war on Yemen, like in May or June of, what was it, 2015, 2016? I don't even remember that. 2015, I think. That there were at that time something like 9 million people, or almost half the population, better than a third of the population, were food desperate, like they were days from starving. And I remember more than a year ago now, journalist Caleb Maupin from RT was part of a you know, the, what do you call the convoy, the ships, that, some boats, a flotilla, trying to bring supplies into Yemen, and they were, you know, basically run off by the Saudi Air Force. They threatened to, and they, I think they even, you know, dropped bombs in the water or something to scare them off, so they couldn't bring food to these people. I can't imagine that they've been having pizzas delivered or anything, and so one wonders how exactly the numbers are even in six figures and not seven or eight at this point.
I remember being told by a UN spokesman when I was still based at the UN, where I was for 25 years, that they were about to declare this, the World Food Program, or the WHO was about to declare this a famine. And that has never officially been done. And as Don and I were talking about before recording, it was for political reasons. The Americans clearly have put pressure on the UN, as they always do, and the Saudis put pressure on them. But I did a piece the very beginning of this war, and I reported that Ban Ki-moon was furious, because I got very good sources that told me that, the way the Saudis were treating him and the UN in terms of the humanitarian crisis they were creating in Saudi Arabia, they just didn't care. And so the UN was muzzled, and Ban Ki-moon had to be muzzled about that, and he actually became angry, which is interesting. I also did a story just after the war began, the outgoing UN envoy of the to Yemen, who was working on Jamal Ben Omar, told me before he was making his last Security Council briefing, before he left to be replaced by a Saudi guy that they liked, they didn't like Jamal, he told me that he believed the war began because he was very close to a deal to solve this thing. And the Houthi had agreed to withdraw from Sana'a. There was going to be UN-trained force take place. The Houthi would take 20% of the seats in parliament, etc. But the only problem was the presidency. Hadi, the guy who was chased out and was living in exile in Saudi Arabia, wanted full power to come back, and the Houthi and the other parties wanted him to be to share power somehow. And then suddenly Saudis started bombing. So I did this
his term was up too, but the agreement that put him in office two years or three years yes. earlier or whatever, his term was up like at the end of 2014, and I think all we're talking about now was February and March of 2015.
Yeah, so this war is horrific. It has to end, and I think the number of deaths in the in Yemen needs to become big news. That's why we ran this story, because that could help move the people in Congress to put pressure on the administration to stop this, stop the Saudi. Now, there's been a story the other day, I don't know if it's true, Saudi Arabia asked the U.S. to stop refueling their planes. Right. They say they're able to do it now. I see a political right. move there, too. They're trying to take the heat off. They see what's going on because of Khashoggi. So they're going to say, okay, we don't need your help. So right. they maybe they're secretly doing it, the U.S. continuing to refuel. But in any case, there's some movement in Yemen now, and it's interesting to see what's going to happen.
See, it's not just refueling, because the U.S. needs sorry, the Saudis need the U.S. AWACS also for
Oh, yeah, exactly. That's why I think it's just right. a political PR move.
Right.
Because there's so much other help the U.S. is giving. The AWACS, I think they're choosing bombing targets. They're giving logistical support. You know, they are doing everything except having American pilots fly those planes and drop the bombs, basically.
So we'll move from that to a story by Sam Husseini, who is usually part of the press corps at the State Department and elsewhere, somebody that you know and have seen out there in the world, talking about somebody that was dragged out of the Helsinki press conference with Presidents Trump and Putin because he had basically the essence of his question on the back of a pad, and that was a violation to not have signs or something, whatever. But they physically dragged him out. Nobody said a word about it. Jim Acosta gets decredentialed after pushing a woman's arm, you know, away from her that was trying to take the mic back from him. And the whole press corps is defending Acosta against that dictator Trump.
Yeah.
What's up?
Well, Sam has written an interesting story here. Yes, I was watching, you know, waiting like a lot of people to see this press conference begin between Putin and Trump, and suddenly this picture zooms in, and I see Sam Husseini in a headlock. I screamed, "That's Sam!"
Right.
So, it turns out Sam did do something unusual. I've been in hundreds, maybe thousands of press conferences over 30 years as a reporter. And obviously everybody wants to get called on, and they call on favorites, and especially in a press conference like this, there's so many reporters.
It was
there.
Huge. It was like a gymnasium or something.
It was in a big hall.
Yeah, huge. Yeah.
A big hall. Yeah. They had these ceiling shots going down. I don't
you
know how
like
many
a dot from the stage. So how if you many want to be seen, something to this distinguish you, yeah.
So Sam put a scrambled what his question was going to be, which was nuclear ban treaty, yeah. Not nuclear test ban treaty.
The INF.
Was a treaty that was passed at the General Assembly, gathering signatures now. Of course, the U.S. is not interested in signing it. I don't think Russia is right now either, but they are.
NPT, right, that's right, right.
The nuclear ban treaty, ban all nuclear weapons.
Yep.
Actually passed in the General Assembly. It's not coming into force yet. I don't think they got enough countries to sign on. But anyway, Sam wanted to ask them about that, Trump and Putin. Why don't you support this nuclear ban treaty, which would have been a totally legitimate and good question. And he wrote it on a piece of paper, nuclear ban treaty, that he was going to hold up. Now, of course, everyone saw that as he was about to hold a protest. And that he wasn't a legitimate accredited journalist at that event, which he was. The Nation magazine, and then Katrina van der Heuvel, the editor of The Nation, wrote on Twitter that he was indeed accredited because Acosta got there, says the guy says he's from The Nation. He was about to protest. So, and of course, within the press corps, the people at CNN or the New York Times, they're elitists.
Is an actual journalist, unlike Acosta. Acosta's a TV guy. He usually reads off a teleprompter or he showboats at a press conference.
Well, he's not in the same class.
Sam's a real journalist.
Sam asks questions that corporate media reporters should be asking.
Right.
For example, he was suspended from the National Press Club a few years back because he actually confronted Prince Turki, who was the head of the Saudi intelligence, who came to Washington and did a press conference at the National Press Club. And in fact, why you do a press conference, you don't expect questions, tough ones.
Right.
Sam asked one, and they suspended him for that. Tells you a lot about the National Press Club, that they would suspend one of their members for asking a tough, rude question of Turkey. Now, in Acosta's defense, to some extent, I think the question he had of Trump that day was legitimate, because I think it's ridiculous to call that an invasion. But he didn't form it in, he didn't ask it in the form of a question. He was making statements.
Right.
Like, this is not an invasion. That's not up to the reporter to say
right.
that.
Right.
You say, well, how can you call this
exactly,
an invasion?
Exactly.
On what basis is this an invasion?
Right.
So your question is pregnant with a statement, but it's not a statement, right?
Right. And so, and the way Trump, because he made a declaratory statement of fact or alleged fact. And Trump said, basically, let me run the country, you run CNN. I mean, that's kind of an appropriate response almost to the way Acosta presented this information.
And the other thing is, if it was against the kind of protocol that I've been involved in all of these high, and I worked at the UN 25 years, so I was at these big press conferences where heads of state and government were there. I never saw anybody hold up a sign like that.
Right.
Sam was not protesting.
Right.
But I also never saw anybody keep the mic that long at a press conference.
Yeah.
Yes. Especially in a White House press conference. You had your questions. You got to sit down after
a
while.
And now the facilitator comes for the mic and you push your hand out, push your arm out of the way.
They're trying to say, the anti-Trump forces are saying that was a doctored video that he didn't really hit her on. I'm not getting into that. I don't really know. But the issue was, there are protocols about press conferences. And normally the other reporters would get if the guy hogs the mic.
Right.
Because, and they didn't in that case because they all hate Trump so much and they saw this as, and I just want to make this, the best point Sam makes in this piece is that they're good for each other. CNN and Trump are helping each other to lock in each other's audiences.
Right.
That people gravitate to CNN, he says, because they hate Trump, and people root for Trump because they hate CNN. So they're like feeding off of each other in this dance that is really horrific. And anybody who has a half a brain is disgusted by both of them.
I mean, it's the same thing that you have between Fox and MSNBC, for example. You have this one is selling this opinion that is antithetical to the opinion this one is selling. They point at each other. They address each other.
And they get
the
ratings.
They have partisans behind them.
Yep.
I'm watching because I hate those people. I'm watching because I hate those people. And by the way, there's a pretty much consensus on fundamental policy outside of the hot button issues like abortion or whatever. Imperialism is never discussed. Actual fundamental institutional racism is never discussed, only in ways that can't be resolved, so that it fuels this thing. All of the systemic problems that face an imperial capitalist post-industrial world, there's consensus on those things to the extent that they're not even part of the landscape. It's like discussing water with fish in the water. So
no, absolutely right. And during these midterms, we saw that. The war did not come up as an issue at all.
Seven wars.
None of them. And these are members of Congress and the Senate and the House who have could have a huge effect on war and peace. That's what they're supposed to, according to the Constitution anyway. So it's horrific. That tribalism that you just described as being is getting the ratings. And that's what it's about, of course, for TV stations, for Fox and MSNBC. And that's the dynamic that Sam writes about here that I think is a quite interesting piece to read.
Yeah, and there's something else that he raises, too, by the way, which is something that we, you know, pretty near and dear to our hearts, because, and we've been working on. How about Julian Assange?
Right.
Hello. I mean, back in 2016, even all the way up to today, when they talk about the Russians hacking and this and that or whatever, what they're actually talking about is the evidence of corruption of Clinton and the DNC that was provided by WikiLeaks via, you know, by Julian Assange's construct that made money for all of those guys throughout the whole election year in 2016 and 2018, for that matter. And his life is in danger, and they don't have not a peep about him as a journalist.
That's right. Sam writes, while corporate media obsesses about Trump's attacks on the press, it says nothing about the administration's possible prosecution of WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange or RT and Al Jazeera being forced to register as foreign agents.
Yeah. And Press TV, too,
And Press TV. So, I mean, the hypocrisy is all around in this story.
Heather Nauert also, she won't take questions now from RT's reporters or from Sputnik's reporters. At the press, she's the press, you know, face, basically, of the State Department, and they won't talk.
I know. It's horrific. It's wrong. Because they ask tough questions, that's why.
Yeah, right.
Not because they're the bad Russians.
Right. Right, because when they were the bad Russians, the bad Soviets, the bad communists, they used to answer their questions.
Interesting.
You know?
Point, Don. Very interesting. Yep. That's right.
So, and then we've got one more story, which is, this is my fave, actually, from John Kiriakou, himself one of those 17 intel agencies whistleblower, suggesting that Brennan and Clapper should not escape prosecution. Let me go into that a little bit.
Yeah, that he thinks they should go to jail, actually. And why?
Yep.
Because there was, during the midterms, when the focus of the media was on those elections, Chuck Grassley, chairman of the Judiciary Committee, he made an announcement. It was November 1st, and he said, which was overlooked by the media, that Brennan had ordered CIA hackers to intercept the emails of all potential or possible intelligence community whistleblowers who may have been trying to contact the Congressional Oversight Committees. That's the House and Senate Intelligence Committees.
Right.
Hacking the computers of the Senate, any Senate computer, is obviously illegal. An illegal use of a government computer, illegal espionage and wire fraud. But Brennan and Clapper did notify Congress of this. And this is what you're supposed to do. You know, the congressional notifications are the way the intelligence agencies inform the oversight committees of various matters. And in this case, they classified it, which is very unusual, to classify the notification. And therefore, they hid behind this classification a crime, which is a crime itself, as John points out. It's a felony to classify a crime.
Right.
It's a felony also to classify something only for the purpose of preventing embarrassment to the CIA. Right. I knew all this because I worked with Tom Drake on a book project once, and I learned a lot of this. And I know about the relationship between intelligence agencies and they actually ridicule, of course, the oversight committees, the intelligence agencies. They do everything to manipulate them. Right. And here's another example of that. Now, there's one thing I have to point out, though, that Grassley says that he could not have revealed this before. Because it was, I don't know why he's doing it now, but it was, he said he couldn't before because it was classified. So it was overclassified.
Right.
The fact is that on the amendment, I think the Sixth Amendment of the Constitution, any member of Congress in the middle of a legislative act is allowed to say anything he damn wants.
Right.
That's what Mike Gravel, Senator Mike Gravel, did when he read the Pentagon Papers into the record.
Right.
So these ideas saying I couldn't, I remember Dick Durbin saying, well, we knew that there was no WMD in Iraq, but we couldn't say anything because it was classified rubbish. He could have stood up there and said it and he could not have been questioned.
That's right.
There are languages you can't be questioned going to or from for anything you do while you're in the middle of it. So you can declassify anything you want and not get in trouble. You cannot publish it in a book afterward or in a newspaper. That's illegal, right. But in the middle of a legislative act. Right. So this is a big story because it's, again, not gotten any attention. And for you listeners out there, this is what Consortium News is trying to do, bring you the stories that you're not getting in the corporate media. We publish 1, 2, 3 stories a day, but they are hopefully stories that either have not appeared or they have a completely different angle than you're getting from the corporate media. And this is a good example.
Serial violators, Brennan and Clapper.
Oh, yeah. I mean, John Kuriakou wrote the piece. Of course, he's a whistleblower. He blew the whistle on torture on an ABC News interview. The guys who did the torture and the war crimes did not get prosecuted because Obama wanted to look forward and not backward. But who goes to jail? John Kuriakou.
Right.
For revealing. Same with Chelsea Manning. The war crimes that those videos that we saw reveal, none of those pilots or their commanders were even prosecuted, let alone gone to jail. Who goes to jail? Chelsea Manning for revealing it. This is a horrifying pattern that we see. This is a corrupt ruling class we have here that are protecting their interests to the point of jailing people who reveal their crimes, which is why they want to jail Julian Assange all together. But they're not going to stop WikiLeaks even if they did that. So that's just payback and sending a message if they can get Assange behind bars. And as we know, he's still in the embassy. So this is an important story, John Kuriakou's story. No question about
it. And then Clapper also. Clapper denies to Senator Wyden in an open hearing of the Senate Intel Committee, in other words, an oversight committee, that the NSA was spying on American citizens and, under oath, by the way.
Yep, public meeting. Right?
Yep. When he's challenged on that, he says, the least dishonest response I could think of.
Can you imagine that?
How about, like, the truth?
Of course, he's never going to be prosecuted for perjury, but he perjured himself. He admitted he perjured himself.
And by the way, the reason he's perjuring himself is because he was asked if he committed a crime, which is what that is.
That's
illegally spying on American citizens.
That's right.
Multiple felonies. Each instance is a felony or multiple felonies, depending on the nature of the wiretaps, crossing state lines, yada, yada, yada.
Oh, just to answer my own question, Grassley's got work to get him declassified, and he finally did. In the Trump administration, they declassified these notifications. So he spoke out. He issued the statement everybody ignored that John's writing about. But again, he could have he could have made this public before in the middle of a committee hearing or somewhere in a speech in the Senate. But, you know, the political consequences are extreme. Your colleagues, after Gravel did that, they wouldn't talk to him. He had no chance of being the head of a committee, a powerful committee anymore. So he was, like, on the outs with the other senators because he read the Pentagon Papers, which far more consequential document than even this. But Grassley got it declassified, so now we know about it. And John, who follows these matters, who knew Brennan very well, worked with him at the CIA, and doesn't like him, and doesn't think he was very bright and all this stuff. He's written a piece about that for us. Has provided our readers with this great story.
Yeah, John was one of the Obama 8, charged with 5 felonies, including 3 counts of espionage. For blowing the whistle on the CIA's torture program. He says in the article, of course, I hadn't committed espionage. Those charges were eventually dropped. That's the kind of thing, though, they charge you with.
Of course.
And then let's sit down and see what you're going to plead to doesn't contain a death penalty, you know, or a life in prison.
Of course. And that's the same thing they did with Drake, and to his credit. You know, they gave him 35 years, espionage and all that. They wanted him to take a 5-year deal.
Right.
He refused.
Yep.
Went right up to the day before the trial, and finally the government realized they had no case. They had to drop it.
Right.
But, you know, I don't know all the details of John's case, but John took the deal and they dropped the espionage. It's exactly right. It's used to get a deal.
Okay. Joe, thanks a lot. We'll speak with you again next week. Again, we've been talking about some of the stories at consortiumnews.com this week. The top 3 at the website. Yemeni war deaths have been underestimated by 5-1. Trump and big media clash or collusion. There's that C word again. And my personal fave, Brennan and Clapper should not escape prosecution. We were discussing all of that with Editor-in-Chief Joe Loria.
It's great to be here in studio with you, Don.
Our pleasure. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.